This is Paul Stringini, and this is a line-by-line Bible study. Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Verse 3. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So let's just hold there a moment and let's consider what he said so far. When he talks about higher powers, the general consensus is that he means governments. Of course, I'm going to want to expand on that a little bit, because as a lot of things you read in the Bible, nobody really follows the Bible absolutely literally. And that's good, because I don't think it's meant to be taken literally at all times. Some things in the Bible are literal. But when you're talking about a teaching, you have to take it in terms of the spirit in which it is said. What Paul is trying to say is that we should be obedient to government and the powers that be, the higher powers as he calls them. Of course, he would not extend that to if they said, oh, we command you to deny the Lord. Paul would say, well, then of course not. So we already know that there are exceptions, right? We understand that this is not meant in an absolute and wooden, literal sense. We are to obey the higher powers, except when it comes into conflict with Christianity. Because to really warrant that obedience and the subjection, Paul says, the rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. If rulers become a terror to good works and become supporters of evil, then you must resist the power, because it is not ordained of God. Well, it may be ordained of God in a certain sense, just as the beast and the false prophet are ordained of God, right? In the book of Revelation, it talks about, you read 13, it says, they worship the dragon, which gave power to the beast. It's a higher power. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? The beast has power. Now, this word power is exousios in Greek. There are several words for power in Greek, like kratos, exousios, dunamis. And exousios, as far as power goes, refers to authority. It is a form of delegated power. When you get power from some higher and more basic or fundamental power. For example, a police officer is a sworn officer of the law. They have power which they exercise, but it is not inherent power. It is power in the form of authority which comes from the law. And all powers eventually trace their authority back to God. So sometimes higher powers, I mean, because you know in Revelation 13, when the beast commands everyone to worship, or when the dragon causes everyone to worship the beast and himself, when that happens, we know it, we should not obey that power. And it's going to be a very strong power, a very convincing power. They're going to rule over the entire world. The appointed power of God at that time will be a power that we ought to resist. You got to remember, Paul is writing to the Romans, under the Romans. So you got to understand his position. He's not going to couch this language here with all kinds of caveats and exceptions. And he's not going to say like, well, you don't have to obey the power if this, or you don't have to do this if that. Paul trusts that if we've received the Spirit, we will understand the sense in which he intends these to be taken. And it's very clear what he's saying. Rulers are not a terror to good works. Are rulers always elevators of good works? You know, you can jump right to the Hitler argument, of course, right? And not all the Roman rulers were, you know, they were the enemies of Christ. But in general, you know, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. There are laws and rules which the government puts out that we should endeavor to be at peace with. And if we can at all avoid coming into conflict with those powers, we should do this. That's why Paul says we should be subject to them. But there's no power but of God. Meaning that, in some sense, if a ruler is not a terror to good works, if a government is not a terror to good works, and in as much as it is not a terror to good works, it should be obeyed. Because that's the ordinance of God. Even the government of Satan is going to put in place, I mean, he's going to have certain rules that we should probably obey. I mean, he's not going to just say, the only rule is you got to worship me. His order is going to have other things in it which we will walk in obedience to. Not because of any sense of allegiance to Satan, but because we're already walking in obedience to those things. But those things which are incidental, meaning maybe we don't really care about it, right? Maybe it's not part of our worldview. Let's say building permits, right? If you have to get a building permit to build in your area, you should get the building permit because that's the rules. There's nothing ungodly about that rule. You may object to it. You may find having to lay out extra money to be a problem, whatever. But if you're required to get permits to do things, you should, by all means, do it. The point is, the government is there for a good purpose, and if the rules don't draw you into conflict with righteousness, then you should obey the rules. You know, there's no reason you need a driver's license in Christianity. If you are able to safely operate a motor vehicle, Christianity gives you the liberty to safely operate a motor vehicle. The Amish aside, you know, their view of things is different. But for most Christians, it's perfectly legitimate to drive a car. And we don't need a license. We have liberty. What do I need a license for? Or hunting. This is God's earth. How dare they require me to have a license to go hunt? You know, it's perfectly legitimate for me to go and kill and support my family. But Paul says we should obey the higher power. And there are reasons they have put those things in place. It is not there to be a terror to good works. You know, if they don't require any license, pretty soon everyone will be shooting all the game and there'll be nothing. They like to track those things, and it's for the good of all. There's reasons. Sometimes it seems like laws have no purpose, and it can be frustrating. You know, just like I said, with the license is obviously for the car is kind of obvious why you need that. Or it didn't used to be. I mean, they didn't always have licenses, but they require you to get one, so get one. Okay? Most people do. Most Christians do follow the incidental ordinances, right? We try to be law-abiding. And when it comes to sin and unrighteousness, obviously we're already trying to obey Christ and be righteous in our behavior and not come into conflict with the law in a matter that would be sin. Obviously on that front. But I think Paul has in mind other matters. Like I said, licenses, duties, fees. He gets on to that, taxes. We should follow the rules and obey the laws. Inasmuch as they do not come into conflict with our serving Christ, we should endeavor to please the powers because we do not want to get on their bad side. As Paul says, they bear not the sword in vain, in verse 4. It means they have the power to incarcerate you and to kill you. The government can kill you. It can kill us. It has the power to do that. A police officer carries a gun. He has authority to kill us under certain circumstances, but he can kill. He didn't want to kill. I'm sure 99.9% of them don't walk out the door thinking they're going to kill somebody. But they have the authority, under the right circumstances, to use deadly force. As it has always been. And, you know, we can be thankful we live in a world where there's a great deal of restraint placed on officers of the law, that they are not allowed to use deadly force just willy-nilly. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? You have to fear the power. And I use this example. I was talking to someone the other day about it. Fear. People misunderstand the idea of fear in a biblical sense. Sometimes I remember my old teacher, Arnold Murray, used to say reverence. Reverence is okay for God, but I don't reverence the power of the world. So what does it mean by fear in that sense? You could say respect, okay? But I like fear in this sense. I don't mean fear as in anxiety. A lot of times people think of fear and they think, anxiety. I got to be afraid of what's going to happen. That kind of anticipatory fear should not be part of a Christian's mindset. We want to cast out that fear. We don't have that kind of fear. That's the fear that the Spirit of God is going to teach us to overcome. We're not going to be among the fearful and unbelieving. We aren't going to be counted among their number. But we're going to fear not, as the scripture says. It says we should fear God, but then it also tells us not to fear. It says us we should fear the power, but do not be afraid of their looks. See, if you took all these things in a wooden, literal sense, you wouldn't know whether you were coming or going. You need to use the Spirit to exercise your mind, to think of it from more than just the one way when you happen to be in this passage. You know, that's so often the case. We get into one passage and we see it one way, then we get into another passage, we see it another way, and we haven't reconciled the two. But the example I use for fear, one time I had a down power line. The supply line, the pole where the supply comes into my property, going to my barn, basically came down in a storm or something, and it was on the ground, and you know, there are two wires. And they kept touching each other, and that would create a white hot electrical flame. And it made this really mean buzzing, like zoom, 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 zoom. And when I came upon it, it had already devoured about 6 feet of itself. I mean, 6 feet of power line, high capacity, you know, supply line for a building had been devoured by its own shorting. You know, just kept shorting out, and you know, zin, 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 and it was causing a trail of flame in the grass. But when I heard the sound of the power line shorting out, and I saw the white hot flame, I felt fear. I wasn't afraid I was going to get hurt. I wasn't anticipating death. I just realized that this was powerful. This was dangerous. And I needed to be careful, okay? And when we talk about the power of God, I'm talking about that kind of power, where you realize how powerful God is. That just being in the presence of something so dangerous should be enough to put your hair on end, you know? I stand in the presence of God. Well, then why aren't your hairs standing on end? Because that's how it should be. Like they believed in the Old Testament, that if you saw God, you would die. Well, if you see God, you could die. Or maybe you have died. I don't know. But it was widely believed that they would see God and die. But there were numerous examples of people who saw God and did not die. But they usually saw the angel of the Lord, or God in some other form. But I suppose that if the human, if we could see all of what God is in a moment of time, it would probably be more input than our system could handle. I don't know. I don't know if that belief was true or not. I just know that people believed it. It's written in the Bible because people believed it. There are things sometimes written in the Bible that people believe that are not necessarily the truth. For example, Rabshakeh, the servant of the king of Assyria, in the book of Isaiah, he tells them they're all going to be eating their own dung and drinking their own urine in no time at all. But that wasn't what was going to happen. So he didn't know, but that's what he believed. So we should fear the power and give it respect. understanding just how dangerous it can be to go against the power. All right, let's see. What clauses do we not cover? We covered to be subject. There's no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whoever resists the power resists the ordinance of God. Ordinance is another word for the rules or the regulations that God has put in place. They that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Damnation. I love that word sometimes. I used to really try to avoid words like hell and damnation because of the connotations they carry among modern Christians, you know, of eternal torment and all that. Because damnation is the Greek word krima, and it just means judgment. Or the sentence, you know. And it implies, you know, if I say, I'm going to sentence you, here's my judgment. It's more like after you've been brought in guilty, here comes damnation or judgment. We do not want to resist the power. That's, you know, honestly, this makes me think of getting all political, honestly. Because the people right now are talking about resisting the government. We are the resistance. Because in their minds, they believe that everything the government is trying to do is evil. That they're a terror to good works. I'm not going to get into it. Not going to get into it. You know, this whole question brings me to things like, well, what about revolutions and stuff like that? And I think I've said in the past that, in a sense, those become powers unto themselves. You know, I mean, if there's a revolution brewing among the people, you know, how do you know which power to resist or which power to go along with when a new government comes sweeping in? Because I tell you, God has not always been on the side of the status quo. That's not what this is saying at all. Paul's just talking this way because he's not going to say this sort of revolutionary talk while in writing a letter that's going to Rome. You know, he's trying to give him an impression of what Christianity is all about. It's written to Roman Christians, but other people could hear this. It's not like it's going to be some big secret. So he has to write it in such a way so that it conveys the right attitude, but without some of the things that we may have to consider if we were going to look at it from more than one perspective. Sometimes the powers that be, that if you think of that in terms of the status quo, is the power that has been and the power that is. And I'm thinking of, like, in the period of the kingdom of Israel. When before the kingdom split, you know, there was David. He had the whole kingdom of Israel, the unified kingdom, and Solomon. It was a unified kingdom. But then Solomon's son Rehoboam, people were saying, "Hey, could you ease up on the taxes and this? You know, your father really drove us hard. It'd be, you know, if you would just ease up a bit, that would be great." And the wise advisor said, "Yeah, back off. You know, your father had a lot of building projects. That's done. And so speak well to the people. Tell them how great it's going to be under you. And you've got their best interests at heart, so to speak. And it's going to be great." And then he had some young advisors, it says, who said basically, "No, no, no. Tell them while my father was hard, I'm going to be even harder." And this is all according to prophecy, because the Lord had already said he was going to wrench the kingdom from his hand. From Rehoboam. So he took 10 tribes away from him and left him with just Judah and Benjamin. So there was a southern kingdom and a northern kingdom. It became the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, two separate kingdoms. That was ordained of God. You know, that the power that was not the power that would be. And so it gets complicated. You know, I'm glad I don't live in the midst of a revolution, but in a sense, you would want to basically remember who you're serving first, which is Christ. But on the other hand, you would want to be on the power that you thought, or with the power, or being obedient to the power that you thought was being obedient to God, or was had the country going to go in the direction that God would have the country go, at least in the direction of righteousness. Maybe God wants a country to go be given over to entire immorality so that it might be destroyed. As he said of the Amorites, you know, their iniquity and sin has not come to the full yet. He didn't want to destroy them yet because their iniquities had not completely filled up. There was more sin they had to commit. That's why when people talk about America, my country, and say, is America about to be judged? I'm like, I don't think so. I think we have more iniquity that we have to commit. It's not yet full. But is it filling? Oh, it's filling. It's filling. And we got the dead babies piled up. We got the sin and iniquity coming out the ears. We've got every abomination, not just the ones people think of. Everyone always thinks of the sexual abominations, but we got all kinds of abominations. We got unjust scales. We got a lying tongue. We have all kinds of abominations. The Bible tells of many abominations. People always just think there's just a couple. There's a lot of things God finds abominable. If you do what's good, you'll have praise of the same. You know, the government's not going to, you know, I mean, and I see, you know, you see it. It's actually true. When people do a lot of good, they get recognized, you know. So, you know, if somebody takes a lot of time to feed the poor, even the Romans would recognize that person as good. Wow, you know, you're really helping out the citizens of our country. You're taking care of the widows. That no one's going to say, oh, you're doing a bad thing. Stop taking care of the widows. Don't do that which is evil. Be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. We covered that. He's the minister of God. Minister means servant, like a household servant, not a slave. There's another word for slave in the New Testament. It is a servant. A revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. That is what the government does, is that it executes wrath, bears the sword. I think we covered that sufficiently. It's kind of self-evident what that means. Let's move on. Do we cover verse 5? Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but for conscience sake? That's what I was saying. Not just because the government executes wrath, but for our conscience. We need to have a clean conscience. Like I said, of course, we're already, for our conscience sake, bringing ourselves into subjection to Christ through the power of the Spirit, that we could walk in uprightness and righteousness and godliness. But again, if we know the rule is you have to obtain a driver's license, then we shouldn't drive without one. And we know that's the rule. We should follow the rules so that we do not have a conflict in our conscience. And the conscience is the moral consciousness of our mind. Our consciousness of moral choices, of right and wrong. We don't want to be knowingly doing wrong. If you have no conscience about something, that is well. There's not a lot of wrath involved in minor transgressions of the law. Like you forget to wear your seatbelt. That's something that happens to me from time to time. I forget to wear my seatbelt. It's the law. I want to wear it. I try to put it on. I don't want to get a ticket. I don't want to get in trouble. I can't say I have a conscience about it, though. I don't feel like I'm doing wrong when I forget my seatbelt. But they'll give me a ticket all the same if they catch me. And I've gotten a ticket for that. But I paid my ticket. Just, $50. I don't like paying that money, but I think I've only paid for one. But I had to pay it. I think it's ridiculous. I don't think I should have to pay it, but I paid it. So now my conscience is clean. As far as like I paid for my transgression, whatever. So what I'm saying is, that's not, I was able to handle that wrath. I received all the punishment that's coming to me for that transgression. I mean, I don't consider it, my conscience does not feel like the blood of Jesus needs to do anything about that. I can pay for that one. You know what I'm saying? So, every flaw in our character, of memory, of omission or commission. You know, they say if you omit something you should do, or you do something you shouldn't do, that those are alike things that are sinful. Okay, but I mean, I really don't have a conscience about the issue. It's not really an issue of wrath. but in things that bring about the wrath of the government, meaning getting arrested, going to jail, punishment, that kind of stuff, let's be subject. You know, we don't want to find ourselves incarcerated or, you know, and labeled then as evildoers by even the world. It's enough that our sins be known to us and God and to our brethren, but to have, you know, your sins require the attention of the outside world is humiliating, and we should avoid it. Verse 6, for this cause pay you tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom is due, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Don't run afoul of the law. You know, pay you tribute means pay your taxes, pay your duties, pay your fines, buy your licenses. You know, get the sticker for your plate. When you pay your taxes, you're paying for them to fulfill righteousness. And they are attending to this as a minister of God. And he's just saying what should be very obvious. You know, if it's only obvious, I think, because we've been raised in a Christian society where these are the values we hold. This is not the opinion everywhere you go in the world. In some countries, you know, bribery is very important, because bribe this guy, bribe that guy, because that's the only way they feel they can get things done. Fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. You know, don't walk into a courtroom and start acting like, you know, you're above the law. If you find yourself in the courtroom, think of honor in the sense of the way they call the judge, your honor. Verse 8. Owe no man anything, but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Oh, no man, don't be in debt if you can avoid it. You know, the only debt I have is my house, and that drives me nuts. I wish I owned this place outright. Someday I hope I will. But I'll tell you what, other than my house, I don't have debts. I used to use credit cards and stuff. I stopped using that stuff, okay? I'm not saying it's wrong to have a credit card or something like that. Some people feel you need it. Like, someone wanted me to rent a car to bring my family somewhere once, and then basically they wanted me to use a certain rental place. And I went in there and I could not rent because I had a MasterCard, but it was the debit because it was my bank card. But my bank card, when I opened the account, I said, I don't want any overdraft protection. If I overdraw, you just reject it. You just reject the charge. I don't want you to pay it and then I have to pay a fine and then pay that. I don't want to go into the hole. If I don't have the money for it, and I'm not smart enough to keep track of my finances to the degree where I don't overdraft, then that's on me. But I don't want you covering it, and then I find out I owe you money now. But there's nothing worse than that. I'd rather just have it be like, well, I guess I better put that back on the shelf. I didn't have as much money as I thought. Though honestly, that has not happened to me. After I got out of debt, I've just been very careful. My bank gives me daily notifications. Every day it tells me what charges have been made on my debit card and what my balance is. And I look at that every single day. I mean, I never had that when I was younger. But with all the things you can avail of yourselves these days, there's no reason you should ever overdraw your account. And get rid of that overdraft protection. Now, this is my opinion. As far as the bank account, don't have overdraft. Now, if you want to have a credit card, if you don't use it, eventually it'll just get canceled on you. You have to make charges. Some say no minimum balance. I don't know. Whatever. If you can find a good one and you got great credit and you want to use it and pay it off all the time, or just carry a very small balance, that's all right. I just had enough of it. I just had enough of that thing. I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to pay it into the future. Instead of paying off my debts in the future, I'm just going to get the things I want in the future when I have the money for them. And that's how it's been, I don't know, I don't know exactly. I want to say 10 years, but I really don't know. Maybe it hasn't been that long. 10 years is not so long. I used to think 10 years was like a long time. I think 10 years is 2007 now. Doesn't seem that long ago. But you don't want to, don't, if you have your credit card, don't start just buying stuff on it. It should be like for an emergency, you know, like your hot water heater goes out. You need something you just can't afford at the moment, and you just absolutely, if it's something you truly need. You know what I'm saying? Like, in my house, maybe it's like an automatic washer, a stove. I mean, I just go get a stove. And, you know, sometimes it's useful to have a credit card for that. But I'll tell you what, instead of buying a brand new one for $400 or $500, you could pick up a used one if you look around. You know, if you're desperate, you could maybe spend a little less and get something not quite as nice. And instead of getting in debt and paying 29% interest or whatever they're charging, you know, just make do for a while until you've got enough to get the one you want. Don't use credit cards as a shortcut to the prosperity you think you'd like to enjoy. Don't use borrowing as a shortcut to the things you think you want in life. You know, a lot of times people use, you know, they go into debt to buy a car. And, you know, that's fine, but, you know, but don't go to buy a new car and get into all that debt. When you drive it off the lot, it loses all its value instantaneously, or just most of it. And get something with 20 or 30,000 miles on it. I'll tell you what, I've never owned a car with less than 90,000 miles on it, to my knowledge. Let's see. No, I've never owned a car with less than 90,000 miles. Maybe, well, I think when I bought my station wagon, it was like a 89,000, or really close to 90. Okay, well, whatever. Most of my cars have had a lot more miles than that, though, I'll tell you. And I've gotten by just fine. So I'm not just saying you should do something that I wouldn't myself do. The thing is, you can get a decent car and have a small loan and hopefully, you know, not find yourself behind. See, a lot of times people, they rush out, they borrow as much money as they can to get the nicest car they can get so they can have that sort of reward their covetousness. You know, they reward their feeling that they need something nice by going out and spending a lot of money on a car. And it's not wise. There's a reason why people who make 3, 4, 5 times as much money as I make, there's a reason why those people are still in debt, still living month to month. It's because they always are living beyond their means. And for some people, that's how it's going to be, consistently trying to live beyond what they have. But if you are content with what you have and can be frugal and save and, you know, and be careful a little bit, or just be willing to delay gratification, you can avoid debt and then just, you know, worry about more important things. I'm not going to say, oh, you can get that car later. It's like, I'll forget that car. If it moves and runs and it isn't, you know, I understand you don't want to have one that's going to fall apart as you're driving it, or something that's unreliable. Of course not. Whatever, that's how I live my life, all right? I don't want to owe people things. It's like an anchor around your neck. But if you owe something, what he says, and I ignored that to talk all about credit cards and garbage like that, but to love one another, that's what you should owe people, love. If you're going to go into debt, let it be for love. I owe you love. Because in loving one another, you fulfill the law. Verse 9. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying. Namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, of course, Paul is quoting from the Old Testament in verse 9.
And he's summarizing the Ten Commandments.
You'll find the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. And the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself is from Leviticus. Leviticus 19, verse 18. The second half of the verse. Leviticus 19 is a very interesting chapter. We'll cover Leviticus at some point. Verse 10. But what he's saying is that there's a lot of laws in the Old Testament. For example, another law in Leviticus 19 was when you harvest, you would not harvest the gleanings. Meaning, basically, to go back and look for every single piece of fruit. Like grapes, there's always gleaning grapes left over. Meaning, you go through and you harvest, you never get everything. Most of the time, it's for most people, it's not worth it to go back. Even when I see farmers harvest out here with the modern equipment, there's always corn that gets spilled or missed, or the machinery somehow spits out. And you will often see farmers send cattle out into the field after a harvest, and the cows will find the stray bits of corn. In the Old Testament, there was a law that said you could not go back and get those. And the point was, it was to be left for the poor. You let the poor go through the field because it's worth it to them, you know, to get that, those last little bits. It's usually not worth it to go and get every single little piece. As far as the amount of effort you'd put into it for what you'd get out of it wouldn't be profitable for someone who is a big farmer or a landowner who is, being blessed with a bountiful harvest. Going back in and getting the gleanings was something you weren't supposed to do. But without that technicality, the point was you will love your neighbor as yourself. Meaning you consider whether or not, if you were left in that situation, what would you want? You know, would you want to go to the field and find it picked clean? Would you like to feel that you could wander through the field and find something to eat? You know, and it's funny because you think about it. It's like, who would wander through someone else's field in the modern times? You go wandering on someone else's property, they call the police on you. So we live in a time when there's kind of a lot of hostility to what used to be considered normal social behavior. Just like with, when people used to be able to move around and just kind of live, and now you have to have a set address. If you don't, you know, you're a transient, a vagrant, or homeless, you know, depending on whether or not they want to show compassion towards you. So, you know, Christ himself and the Apostle Paul also are saying that basically, very much the law as far as dealing with your fellow men can be pretty much summed up in love your neighbor as yourself, or as Jesus would say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They call that the golden rule. That's what it's called in the Christian vernacular. So if you're following that, it's very unlikely you're going to come into conflict with the government unless the government is given over to evil. I just add that. Paul doesn't say that because he doesn't want to come into conflict with the government at all. Whereas I have a constitutional guarantee of a right of free speech, so I can say it. Verse 10. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. If you're loving people, you're going to fulfill the law. And like I said, it's not necessarily the same way you love a brother, the way you love a neighbor, or the way you love an enemy. Like, you don't have to feel like a familial affection for them necessarily. But what he's saying is show them the same respect and kindness you would want shown to yourself. You know, respect their property, respect their privacy, respect whatever it is that needs respecting that you would want done to you. And also consider what they would want done to them. You know, I may say like, well, if I was in that position, I would want someone to come and tell me what's right and what's wrong. You know, maybe. Maybe that's what you should do. But what if
you were, you know, but what if they don't want you to come and do all that stuff? You know, if you didn't want someone to come and harass you about some issue that was meaningful to them, you wouldn't want someone to come and harass you over that issue. Just because you may have a particular issue that you think, well, I would want someone to say something to me. If they don't want someone to harass them about it, and I say harass, I mean, because I think, you know, you got to be able to communicate to some degree. And then you feel it out, and if you feel like it's a problem, then you back off. As much as it is possible, live peaceably with all men. Try to find peace with people. If you know that talking with someone, you know, a hostile party, neighbor, relative, if you know it's going to create friction and stuff, well, then perhaps it's best to avoid the situation. And if anything good is going to come of it, you know, maybe that's the good. Maybe that's your way of loving them, is by not, you know, agitating them. And I'm not trying to, I feel like it's beginning to sound like I'm saying, like, oh, you know, don't say things that might offend people, such as preach the gospel. Yeah, you preach the gospel. But once it's preached, you know, I don't think it's of a necessity. If it doesn't take hold, you don't have to stand there and keep trying to make it work. You know, maybe come back later, much later, depending on, you know, let the Spirit lead you. But, you know, you can waste a lot of time trying to make seed grow in ground that is not fertile. You can also waste a lot of time trying to make a seed grow in fertile ground when it's the wrong season. People are not always at the right stage in their life to receive the gospel. You never know beforehand what exactly situation you're walking into. You can put a lot of effort into it, and you can try to force it. And the thing is, if it's not fertile ground, the likelihood is that whatever grows isn't even going to bear fruit, because it wasn't supposed to from the beginning. Meaning this is that, yeah, you see religions, I don't know how I'm getting off on this, but let's talk about it. You see religions like, I'll just pick on some cultic groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons. And they go out and they really try to proselytize people. Some Christian groups put a lot of effort into proselytization, which means proselytization is the process of converting people to your religion. What they do, though, is they contrive ways to get people to get involved and to agree, and they construct programs and methodologies for converting people. You know, maybe they give someone, you know, you're a part of that church or that group, and you get a packet, and they teach you how to get people to convert. Like, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses come by the houses, and there's usually an older one or a more experienced one with a less experienced one, trying to show them how to get people to join their religion. And so they have a lot of practice on that because they're going door to door. So they develop methods of getting people in. And what I'm saying is, I could go around and try to get people to join me, quote unquote. I don't think this would work for me, but whatever. But for some groups, you know, a lot of Christian groups, what they do is they emphasize things like salvation. They emphasize that you'll be saved from hell. And they emphasize positive aspects of the religion. And they'll emphasize things that perhaps they think will make it more attractive to those people. They try to attract them. People end up drawn into the religion based on some pushy salespeople, essentially. Because sometimes people just don't have much of a will. Meaning, if I pressed myself on someone, I could get them to become my disciple. I could find some weak-minded person, pick out the issues that they care about, pick out the things that attract them, pick out the ways I can manipulate them, and I can get them to join me and become my disciple. Now, whether or not they're going to be able to endure all the things I have to say and teach is a question we'll leave out. But that's the point, is like, if they can't, I guess we won't leave it out. That's the point, because what's going to happen is they'll come in, become my disciple, but their heart's not in it. Yeah, I've basically bullied them into becoming part of, you know, my group or whatever. And so they're part of it, but their heart isn't in it. And their heart wasn't prepared for the gospel, but rather they've been drawn into this relationship. And they may stay with me forever as far as their whole lives. They may be part of my group, but if their heart's never in it, they may always just kind of linger around, be kind of useless, you know, but be part of it. Oh yeah, I'm still part of it. You know, like it's like being in a club or something. And that's what a lot of churches is. A lot of people are just there, just it's part of their, that's their club. You know? And they're not bearing fruit. They're not really interested in the things of God. I mean, they're interested in the things that they got persuaded to be part of the church for. They want to be saved. They want to escape damnation. All those things. They're still on board with that. And they're not, you know, big troublemakers. You know, they're sinners, of course. We all are. And we all need Christ's blood so that we can be cleansed and become righteous people. But they will bear no fruit because they were not intended. The God, if you just preached the gospel to them, they would have been like, oh yeah, and just gone their way. And the seed would have been unfruitful. But instead, I've spent a lot of time getting them in and what? Just to build up my kingdom, I suppose. I don't know. Anyways, so I think that was off track a bit. Let's see. I guess because I started thinking about loving people. And what's more loving than preaching the gospel, right? That's what people tell me. They want to be able to preach the gospel. Well, keep it simple. I'm not going to get into that because I just kind of went off on that as one aspect of love. How you love people. And sometimes loving people is not trying to manipulate them. You wouldn't like to be manipulated into joining a group that your heart wasn't really in it. If my heart really wasn't in something, I wouldn't want someone to keep trying to force me in. You know, if the Shriners showed up and tried to get me to join the Shrine or whatever, or the Masons or whatever, some other group, trying to pressure me into joining their thing, I wouldn't appreciate it if my heart wasn't really in what they were all about. Like when you get those calls, you know, trying to get you to join a timeshare or something, trying to get you to switch electric companies or whatever. All kinds of things, trying to pressure you to do things that you're ignorant of and you don't know much about, but you suspect they may not have your best interest in mind. Or maybe you're willing to believe they do, but maybe they don't. We want to have the best interests of everyone we preach to, and we want to have their best interests in our hearts. Not merely preaching the gospel. And it's always better for someone to come in, that basically the Lord has opened their hearts to the gospel, and then it comes from within them, as opposed to from me. It comes from within them to ask and to pursue it. I sought after Christ. Now, I didn't know he was the one drawing me, but it came from me. Nobody pushed me into it. You know what I'm saying? It's something I cared about, I went after. And pushing people into it, sometimes we love people and we feel like we want things for them, but we're not necessarily doing it the best way. Be patient with people. You would like people to be patient with you. Do unto others. Be gentle. Don't spoil things for others by, you know, making it bitter. Okay. Verse 11. And that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. There was this time in the past when we first believed. And now our salvation is closer. What an interesting thought, considering that most Christians talk in terms of, well, when did you get saved? I got saved, 10 years ago. Gee, how could it possibly be that my salvation is growing nearer than when I first believed? If that's the case. Because the promise of salvation is not the same as the end of salvation. And Paul is always thinking onward, upward. The end of our faith is our salvation. It is the end
for which our faith is given to save us. Our faith is in a promise of salvation. And we only speak in terms of being saved in that we have such confidence in God's promises. So Paul says, our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed.
The night is far spent. This is verse 12. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. That's a great little sequence. I love Paul's attitude. He's very much onward and upward. You know, the time, it is now. The time is at hand. Right now. Now is the time. Let us, therefore, throw off the works of darkness right now. Why didn't you do that last week? Let's do it now. You know what I'm saying? It's like, don't look back at the mistakes. We can't change it. We can regret. We can learn. I was saying to someone recently, there are many things in my life I regret. But I, through Christ, I try to live without regret. Because everything I ever did, and all my mistakes, they brought me to where I am now. And in the end, it's all going to bring me to where I need to be in Christ. So why should I regret it? It'd be like regretting my children. Regretting so many things. I mean, I can understand if you lived your life in such a way that, like, you know, maybe when you're 18, you committed murder. And then you spent your life in prison. You might regret that deeply. But it doesn't mean you can't make the most of it from where you are. I guess that's a tough pill. Even tougher for the victim. Okay. I like his onward and upward preaching here. Wake up now. Stop sleeping. Maybe in the past you were asleep. I don't want to live with regret, okay? I regret things. I could regret them. But instead of letting that drag me down, I try to learn from my errors. I hope you can learn from my errors and learn from your own errors. That's why I don't take down old Bible studies, and I don't think I ever will. I print retractions of things that I think were wrong or corrections. Well, Paul, aren't you worried? It's like, the, you know, some young person might listen to you say something that's got the wrong attitude. I was like, well, maybe. But when I was listening, when I was young, I was listening to much worse, to a teacher that was far more poisonous than anything I've ever said or taught. You know, when I was young, I was a student of Arnold Murray, and I think that his teaching and philosophy are poison. And so, you know, I think of the things I taught like 5 years ago or 6 years ago, more like 8 years ago, when I first started doing Bible studies. It's like, yeah, I was really focused on certain things. I felt like things were getting passed by. You know, I was very laser focused on righteousness and holiness because so much of Christianity ignores those issues or it doesn't give them the prominent place that they really deserve. I mean, let's cast off the works of darkness. Let's throw them off. But in church, so often you'll just hear like, oh, well, you know, if they start talking about sin, they're going, well, now we're all sinners, and you probably sinned this week, and I probably sinned this week. And they'll talk about the blood of Jesus forgiving their sins. But so very rarely will they talk about, and now today, let us cast off the works of darkness. Let's put on the armor of light. Let light be your armor. Do you dwell in light? It has helped me in my struggles to dwell in light. Meaning dwell where I can be seen. And not in secret. In the secret places, you know, like they say, idle hands are the devil's workshop. And in the darkness, evil deeds are done. Spend too much of your life in darkness, you will be alone and tempted. That's one of the important things about some sort of fellowship. You don't have to have a church, but a friend, a spouse, pen pal, anything to try to get more fellowship. I do think face-to-face is important. At least a spouse is good. Or other brethren. You know, if you don't have any brethren, make brethren. People have asked me about visiting churches. I'm like, go ahead. I've met people in religious places, you know? I mean, I met a couple people I've known over my life through kind of secondhand, through a friend of a friend type of a situation. But, you know, for the most part, and you know, some were neighbors, right? I met neighbors who were godly people. Or at least, you know, they gave lip service to godliness, which is, I think, a great start. But for the most part, to find people, you're going to find them in churches. They may not be at the core of the church. You know, you don't want to necessarily look to the pastor and his inner circle. Because a lot of times, you know, I'm not going to get into a discussion about that right now. I've talked about it many times. A lot of times, that's not the place to look. Look around the fringes. See who's there visiting with you. See who else has come in for just that one time. They're not a regular, but they're there today, just like you. Maybe the Lord has bid them to come, as he bid you to come. Let people know that it's your first time visiting. See if you can find any others that are visiting for the first time. Who knows? Maybe the Lord has made it that you both visited the first time. And, you know, that's just, I think, very logical as far as you'll find Christian people in Christian gathering places. I don't say you have to become a member there, but you need to find people who you can talk to, people who you can spend time with. It's good. It's good to be in the light, and there is no greater light than the light of another believer. Let your light so shine. The light of the believer is the light of the world. You know? The light of the unbeliever, of the powers that be, it's just the light of damnation. You know, you do wrong and they're going to uncover it and it's going to be trouble. Right? But the light of the believer is the light that brings about righteousness, that brings forgiveness. The powers that be have only very limited flexibility in forgiving transgression. But the Christian has absolute power to forgive and to restore. So we can arm ourselves with light. We can be clothed in light that the darkness cannot harm us. Because people think of the darkness as external. I remember when I first moved into the country, sometimes I was a little nervous going outside at night in the darkness. And because I'm not beyond, you know, superstitious fear or, you know, just, I think less so now. But when I was younger, yeah, I could get a little spooked. You know? And, because I'd never really spent time so isolated. But, it made me think about it. I'm like, you know, the enemies are not out here necessarily, but they're going to attack me in here, in me. They're going to go after me in my mind and in my home. So I want to be watchful and dwell in the light at all times. Let us walk honestly. That's another term for being clothed in armor of light. You know, walking honestly. And the word means decorously. It is an adverb from a word that means well formed. It means appropriate. Let us walk in an appropriate way. As in the day. Meaning, so as people would see you. Not in rioting. What does rioting mean? It is a carousal. As if letting loose. A carousal. I guess the word it comes from means to stretch. Yeah, to kind of let it all hang out. Maybe that's the English idiom that answers that. Not in hanging out. I tell you, I remember, I don't mind the term hanging out. All right. But sometimes I've had fellowship with Christians who just wanted to hang out. Like let's just play video games. We're two Christians, right? And let's just play video games. and let's just watch football, and let's just do everything except talk about things that that are meaningful to us as Christians, as meaning why we even are sitting in the same room. But my point is, like, I don't want to sit around just playing games with you. I don't want to sit around watching movies with you. The reason I'm interested in you, and this is not meant to be a slam, is because you indicated an interest in Jesus Christ and in his way and in the Christian religion in particular. And that's why I thought I'd hang out with you, so we could talk about that stuff. Not so we could just hang out. Okay, and I know carousal is usually meant to be, ooh, a carousal. Yeah, we know that there are a lot more wicked things in this world than people sitting around playing video games. And I'm not saying if you like playing games, whatever, I'm not trying to rip on you. But my point is, if I come to your house, don't say to me, Paul, let's play some games. You know what I'm saying? What you and I have in common is much greater. Like, why would we waste time with that? I understand there's like a sort of a wisdom in like saying, like, well, we play games with other believers because it's holier. Is it? It's just a common activity. Everybody does that. It's like going to the movies. I don't mind going to a movie once in a while. I think some movies are very stimulating. Just as some books are. I read books. I don't really read books. I listen to books. When I'm working with my hands, I like to listen to books. When I don't mind taking some time out for leisure and entertainment in moderation. And if I'm getting together with someone based on our Christianity together, I want to sit and talk about Christianity. I'm sorry. I want to embrace our Christian ideals. I want to rehearse the good things. I want to exhort you and be exhorted by you. That's why I want to hang out. I'm not saying you can't do other things, but I'm just saying, okay, because like I go wrestling or grappling, you know, it's basically the whatever. I wrestle with my kids and other adults and some young people. I go do that as a physical activity. And some of those guys are Christians. And some of them I don't know. I don't know what their views are. But I don't pretend that that's fellowship. You see what I'm saying? I don't pretend that because I'm a Christian, you're a Christian, wouldn't you like to be a Christian too? That because we're hanging out together and doing things, I don't pretend like that's fellowship. It's not. But so many believers I've known in the past, they'll just hang out and they'll say, isn't this great fellowship? I hope the Bears get a first down. I don't find that stimulating. I don't want to hang out with you and watch a movie. Now, I might. If we are together all the time, like my wife, we're together all the time. So I do enjoy hanging out with her and watching a movie. But if you're a rare brother, if you're a rare brother and I don't see you all the time, I want to talk to you about Jesus. Yeah, there's a place for hanging out. Obviously, Paul probably has in mind the kind of carousal, letting it all hang out, that Christians don't participate in generally. I know, maybe I'm a bit of a stickler. Okay, but I've had so much bad fellowship and some good that I really put a great high value on good fellowship over the other stuff. The stuff that's just like, it's like church. I'm sitting next to you and I'm listening to a lecture on Christianity. That's not fellowship. Okay? Fellowship is, there's two involved. Yeah, I mean, you can't have a one-way fellowship. Then it might, because you know, that's the thing. It's like, then you might as well just watch a TV minister. You might as well just listen to my Bible studies. If people think, just, you got to go to church every Sunday and listen to the sermon and sing with everybody, you might as well sing along with me and listen to my Bible studies only. I never even tell people to do that. I always say it is healthy to have fellowship. I've never encouraged people to forsake the gathering together of believers. I've never encouraged that. But I do discourage people from joining church or becoming committed to an organization. Because then they're going to act like they're the power. I don't know what power is coming and what power is going, but the day will make it manifest. Which power is rising and which power is falling. Rioting, drunkenness, obviously, right? Obviously. Let's walk decorously and not drunkenly. Not in chambering. Cohabitation. That's what it means. I don't know if it refers to living together or to just spending the night. You know, one night stands, all that kind of thing. Wantonness. I always look at my Bible the way it defines a word like wantonness, which is a little bit unusual in our modern. You know, we don't use the word want. Well, we use wanton, like wanton destruction, right? Sort of unbridled, right? Unbridled destruction is a synonym for wanton destruction. A lot of times you can, from context, figure out what things mean. But it's sort of a sexual wantonness, right? Not in strife, quarreling. You know, it's just, we should strive for the faith. But there's another kind of striving that is ungodly. You gotta know when and what. When to zig, when to zag. When it's time to fight, when it's time that God has not called us to fight. Right? But there is a meaningless, worldly strife. I don't want to get into argument. If people are going to get into arguments that don't mean anything to me. Like I heard a guy on the radio talking about getting into an argument with some other guy at a bar about some quarterback or something in sports, about who was better or whether this guy was the Hall of Famer or whatever. You know what I mean? Like some one of those arguments where I'm sitting there having strife with someone over some pitifully insignificant thing. The honor that that we believe a sports team might deserve. And then he was talking about, I got an argument, and he was seeing that this was foolishness. He was arguing with someone about whether the Beatles were great or important in the history of music. Because some young person thought they were overrated. You know? Getting into those kinds of arguments about stupid worldly things. But if someone's going to say, there is no God, contend earnestly for the faith. You can argue about that. Now you're getting into something worth arguing about. There are some things worth fighting for. Just as there are some things which we will not obey the government for. If the government says, you may not worship Jesus, we tell the government, you may not command us so. We will worship Jesus. And envying. Strife and envying. Envying, the word envy comes from the word zeal, or Greek, in Greek it's zelos. It's the same word from which we get zealot or zeal, but it means heat, passion. And I said, there you can be passion. There are things to be zealous for. Paul talks about it, and the other apostles do, to being zealously affected in a good thing. There is a zeal which is after godliness. There is a jealousy for the truth. Jealously guard the truth. Jealously cling to the light. But there's a jealousy which is of the world. A passion that is of the world. I'm jealous over my sports franchise. I defend them with all my might. No one's going to talk against my quarterback. I don't know why I'm on that sports thing, but people are like that. Someone says a bad word about my favorite sports figure, well, we're going to have an argument. You know, a lot of times people enjoy those things. I enjoy debating things with people who disagree with me. If it's about the right, if it's something worth my time, I enjoy it. And I don't become hostile necessarily. That's another thing. If you get into some sort of defending the faith situation, to keep your cool. Don't start condemning people, getting angry and flying off the handle. If you can't handle it, you can't handle it. Remember, being defeated in the short term is never a concern for a Christian because it's the long haul. Maybe you don't have the tools necessary to argue something before someone, or maybe you didn't know something and they presented you with an argument that you've never heard before, and so you're humiliated and defeated. Do not allow wrath to come in, and then you double your defeat by showing yourself ungodly to them. You got to remember, I talked about this recently in another study. It hasn't come out yet, but you got to believe in what you believe in. You know, believe in the rightness of your cause. Even if you're defeated at the moment, say, well, I wish I could make a better argument for it. I really believe what I believe. And I'm not going to be shaken. And you don't say that, but you behave like, I'm not shaken at all. That's a good point. I haven't really thought of that. And I can't think of any answer for you right now, but, you know, the thing is, if you're not in a big public thing and, on TV, even then, it's even more important to keep your cool. You know, the guys who are the pro apologists and all that, they got a lot of cool. They got to keep their cool. You don't want to go unhinged. It always looks bad. So in your small way, you keep your cool too. Don't let them get under your skin. Don't let your zeal overcome you and cause you to sin. Because your zeal for Christ can lead you to do things you shouldn't do. I see it all the time. You know, people, what happens is they talk like maybe to an atheist or unbeliever. They say something and their argument doesn't work. They come back with an intelligent reply to what was said to them. And the Christian becomes frustrated. And instead of just dealing with it in an appropriate way, they lash out. It's not good. I think part of the problem is that so many believers go out and try to make disciples when they haven't even made disciples of themselves. They're not fit to go out and convert people. They don't have the wisdom. They haven't obtained the gifts. You know, they're trying to make 10 talents out of one. You know, you don't have enough capital to have that kind of profit. You got to build up your Christian capital by working on yourself. And don't get cocky and arrogant and start feeling like you got to win every argument. There's some very clever people, unbelievers. They're there to challenge you. And I think they can all be defeated. But it sometimes, you know, I haven't always had the right answer for every question that's ever come to me at the moment it came up, the first time I heard it. You know, we have to experience things. So we be patient, we get our training, we get our experience, and then we will become more competent. And we will be better able to express things. And we won't bring an ill name to Christ by losing our cool at the time we most need to keep it. Meaning, the time you most need to keep your cool is when you are falling short in, as far as in wisdom or wit or being able to reply to something and have an answer for an unbeliever. If you can't come up with that, it is so important for you not to become selfish and start trying to just make them feel, like basically throwing hell at them or something like that. Or start insulting their intelligence or going for some sort of rhetorical victory. And a rhetorical victory is basically when you win the war of words without actually winning the underlying argument. And be careful about strife and envying and passion, heat. It does mean envy or jealousy or zeal. It means all those things. Heat, like, I want that. I want to preach the gospel. That's a good, I'm zealous for it. Good. That's jealousy. I'm very jealous of the gospel. I want the truth to be proclaimed, not a bunch of lies. It's a good jealousy. But don't let it overrun you and cause you to fail. Because you came up short. I don't know why I try not to say you all the time, because I don't mean you as an individual. I mean me or any individual. I mean, I've certainly, I've been the person who did this at some point, I think. I'm just going to say I was. I must have been at some point. How else could I have learned this? I think I might have learned it pretty quick, though. Verse 14. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. We had already read that verse, but we didn't talk about it. We don't want to, you know, provision for the flesh. Meaning, we're going to premeditate and take forethought to fulfill the lust of the flesh. We want to take forethought to fulfill the will of God, to fulfill the will of Jesus. Not the lust of the flesh, but the passion of Christ. We want to be passionate. We want to be heated for good things. We want to be zealously affected to do good things. but not so much that it becomes really an occasion to the flesh. We're zealous for Christ because we want to be important in Jesus. We want to make converts. We want to do things. We want to have a ministry. We want to build our kingdom in this world, or Christ's kingdom, we mean. We want to build Christ's kingdom. We want to do a big thing. We want all the people to hear our voice. We want all the people to read our words. And so we have to go and break the rules. We can justify our shortcomings in terms of our passion. Well, maybe I'm not right, but I'm passionate. No. No. Put on the Lord Jesus. He was humble. He knew. He's like, you do not know what spirit you are of. Now is not the time. He knew there were limits. A sower went forth to sow. Some seed fell among thorns. Some fell on the path. Some fell among the stony ground. And some fell on good soil. And only that which fell on good soil brought forth fruit. So he knew that not everything he was going to do would be profitable. But he focused on the people who would bring profit to God. And so we should endeavor to do that. You want to find those who are going to be profitable. You want to find people who are going to be productive. You want to find people who are truly interested. You don't want to just drive them into it. So that's not really Paul's focus, but those are things that I think of when Paul talks about these things. It's important that we love one another. But sometimes, I guess, I think about it in terms of how that love can go astray. It's good to be passionate, but how can that passion go astray? Well, seeing that Paul gives both sides of it. You know, cast off the darkness, put on the armor of light. To me, he's signaling that duality. There is good government and bad government. There is good zeal and bad zeal. There is Jesus Christ, there is his body, and there is our flesh. So let us put on the body of the Lord Jesus and cast off the flesh. Cast off the works of darkness. The old ways. Remember, you were cleansed from your sins. That's going to conclude our study. This is Romans chapter 13. This has been Line by Line Bible Studies with me, Paul Stringini. You can find all my Bible studies on oraclesofgod.org. That's oraclesofgod.org. Oraclesofgod.org. You can go to the studies page. You find all kinds of books of the Bible. There's a doctrine page. You can find all kinds of single subject studies. Also, those are found on the questions page. I think those pages need to be brought together because a lot of them are duplicated. You want to know about predestination, election? I got a study for that. You want to know about other issues that aren't there? Well, you can send me an email. Go to the contact page on oraclesofgod.org. And you will find my email address. I don't give it in the study because occasionally, every decade or so, I change my email address once the spam gets too thick. Because eventually, the spammers get my email, and then I get, you know, wall-to-wall investment advice and whatever, and letters from Nigeria telling me I've got millions of dollars just waiting for me in a secret bank account. Anyway, so go to the contact page. You can ask me any question you like related to the Bible, Christianity, or I will consider other questions too. People have asked me about UFOs, things like that, dinosaurs, questions like that I've covered. Thank you for listening. I hope it's been a blessing to you. I look forward to studying with you again.